So the promise today was that we would get off the Daniel narrative highway and we would head to the zoo. And I am keeping that promise. For all of you sitting here, is this the first time that you may have explored the prophecies in the book of Daniel? How many here that it might be the first time, especially at Daniel 7 is where we're at. So nobody's first time. If there was anybody first time, I just want to welcome you. I want to welcome you to the zoo. Okay, it's a strange zoo. We'll get to know it very well. How many here have pretty much heard it their entire Adventist life? Okay, how many here probably could already tell me the prophecies that are about to come and who they represent? Well, even if you are, I want to welcome you also. I want to welcome you back to the zoo. As I've wanted this to be in through this entire series is that one of the overarching principles is that prophecy needs to be viewed and discussed at length. I'm not against going back and continuing for us to look at prophecies that may seem routine to us because we have heard them all our life. I'm not against that at all. I just don't want to do it for no reason. If we're looking for Jesus to begin to reveal himself even more in the prophetic verses, because that's what Daniel is. Daniel is an apocalyptic book. It's a revealing book. Every time that we do this, every time that we go into this exercise, we should have him revealed even more to us. This isn't like reading this back in 1844. A lot's happened since 1844. A lot of what this, how this prophecy applies has happened. A lot has been revealed. Daniel unlocked other passages in Revelation. It unlocked Revelation 13 and Revelation 10 for us. We should at least be willing to have God reveal himself more to us. What do we know more today than we did 180 years ago? But the reason that I think that it needs to be done carefully is that we need to be even more careful on how we apply it. Because if we don't, misapplication of prophecy can be used to hurt and harm real people. Not just concepts, not just religious forces, not just principalities, not just denominations or churches. We're talking people. We're talking real people that could be given a wrong context, that could be truly offended by what has come across. All I'm saying is that if we've been studying this for 180 years and we have tried to figure out how to teach other people about it, we should at least be better at it than we were 180 years ago, shouldn't we? And we should be better at not having to intentionally or unintentionally hurt anybody with this. The spirit of prophecy is the testimony of Jesus, Revelation tells me. God's willingness to be fully present with his people, that is the testimony of Jesus. Prophecy always has been God's presence in other people. If God wanted to give his voice, he didn't put it on a billboard. He didn't necessarily write it down. He came to men and women and was present with them, gave them words and prophetic ways to come in order to be able to communicate his will to his people and reveal himself more. That is the spirit of prophecy. It's his spirit. It's his presence. And the most overarching thing when it comes to Daniel and being in exile in this nation at the time called Babylon is that we see now at least two ways to worship. We have the very human concocted way of worship. We have human created gods and how we worship these human created gods versus the God who reveals himself to worship him as living God. We've experienced in the narratives that Daniel and his other Hebrew princes They lived extraordinary lives of the testimony of this presence with God with them. They had God with them. And through these narratives, these extremely difficult narratives, we saw the presence. We saw how they treated their tormentors and their captors. We also see how, beginning with a king like Nebuchadnezzar and going all down through history, what a forced religious idolatry looks like. When you use the mightiest of human power on the earth at the time, Babylon itself, who has conquered much of the civilized world and taken them into captivity, and then scared and coerced and forced them to worship the human gods that they concocted. Nebuchadnezzar's message to Daniel and his friends was, "I'm your God now." Versus the worship of the living God. The worship of Babylon versus the worship of Jerusalem. And by the way, this idea of concept of Babylonian worship, the concept of Babylon and worshiping a false god, is going to take us all the way to the end of the world. The end time message is not the church against the world. The end time message is not believers against non-believers. The end time message is two churches and two gods and two separate ways to worship them. That's the decision we make. We worship the living God or we worship the God of Babylon. And those two gods ask for our worship in very different ways. The human concocted one, the Babylonian worship or the Babylonian force, what makes it Babylonian is using the human power and will that was given. Name the strength or power that nations have over other nations, that anybody can have over any other group of people at any given time. Political power, military power. Power that gets things done in this world, and they are perfectly okay with using fear and coercion and forcing to worship, even to the point of death. And the whole world worshiped the beast. Why? Because if they didn't, they would die at the hands of the beast. Or then you have the worship of the living God, the worship of Jerusalem, the story of the all-powerful Creator God who condescends, who decides to come down out of the high places in which he only dwells and comes down to serve rather than be served, to give evidence that he created them and that he loved them, and to tell them that since they were created this way, they are free to worship me or not. The human gods don't do that. The human gods demand your worship. The human gods see nothing wrong with eliciting it out of fear or coercion. The church of the Lamb that was slain would never, ever ask for that. If we worship the living God, we do so by choice. And we are free to worship him or not. We are free to experience life, or if by choice, we are free to experience death. So something to look forward to as we begin to open up this vision is to look at a verse that's within it. In verse 27, it says, "The kingship and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms." We're going to look at all of the earthly kingdoms of those that at one time ruled the entire world. All of these kingdoms, it says, "All the greatness of those kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the holy ones of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey them." All of the persecution, 1,260 years, everything that all of these earthly kingdoms can do to force us into this form of this perversion of human power and religious power coming together, that's Babylon right there. All of this, thousands of years of eliciting this, thousands of years of martyrdom, thousands of years of false worship versus true worship. And yet, somehow, in the end, it's those who worship the living God that will be given the kingdom. So as we begin to untangle this vision and its fulfillment of the church and the world, I think that one thing that we can agree is that we're not going to pull this off. This can't be a human concoction. In fact, this is a side-by-side comparison of the human concocted way, the human concocted prophecy versus the one of God, the one of the living God. Okay? So welcome to this strange zoo we are about to become acquainted with. In the first year of King Belshazzar of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head as he lay in bed. Then he wrote down the dream. We're immediately drawn back. We're taken out of the timeline. Because in chapter 5, we had already experienced Belshazzar. Babylon had already fallen. In chapter 6, we were already into the Medo-Persian kingdom. Daniel's taking us back to the timeline, back so that we can actually start kind of over. And that can show how Daniel 7 compares, if you will, to another dream that was had. When he says that he had dreams and visions, where have we been? Who do we immediately think of? Where does our mind go right now? Chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream in chapter 2. And he was shown a what? He was shown a statue. And the statue was made out of different metals. And it covered a particular time frame. It went from the time of Babylon, in which Daniel and his friends are now living, and it goes all the way to the end of the world. These four beasts that we're about to meet match up with that. It is the same timeline. And it actually gives us then an interpretation framework on which to go on. Daniel wants us to remember this statue and what he already told us about this statue back in chapter 2. Because the interpretation will be based on this. It covers the same time. It has the same segments in it. There are four. And it begins with Babylon and goes all the way to the end of time and the government that we see that will be set up at that time. Daniel said, I saw in my vision by night the four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea, and the four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. Immediately, you're touched with the universality of this vision. This vision is for everybody. How do we know that? Because once he mentions water and once he mentions wind, we are taken immediately back to Genesis. We're going all the way back to creation. When the wind moved across the waters and he began to create something out of nothing, everybody who's ever lived will be affected by this particular dream and vision. It's the whole world and the whole of humanity in it through this timeline. Something real interesting before we meet our first beast. It says the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. So I call this a zoo, but the problem is that the animals in this zoo only have partial zoological classification. They're familiar images. Certainly, a lion is a familiar image. Daniel recognizes him as a lion, but it isn't a lion. It's like a lion. Why? Because this lion has what? This lion's got wings. So put together, it's surreal, isn't it? Anybody ever had a dream in which something was familiar, but it wasn't quite right? Somebody who didn't belong in the dream, either time-wise. Somebody who's dressed inappropriately for the dream. Makes it surreal, right? So that's what's happening here. It's surreal. And Dr. DeCon, in his book, The Secrets of Daniel, points out this way, is that this makes it more of a nightmare than a dream. Because you never have full footing. When Nebuchadnezzar had his dream, how did he feel about it when he woke up? He was frustrated. He was scared. By the way, when Daniel wakes up from this dream, he'll actually be physically ill, sick, and he doesn't recover for a long, long time. So the images I use are from my friend Nathan Green, and I can't look at Nathan's paintings and see a nightmare, but it's like a lion, because the lion has what? It has wings, okay? Note two, and I don't think this is too far out in left field, but God is also saying, this is not of my will as a creator. See, according to Genesis 1, the animals all gather according to their what? According to their kind. There are species, there are genres, there are classes. They all come together according to their kind. And when you get to Leviticus 19, Israel is actually forbidden to take two different species and mate them together. Why? Because you're messing with creation. I don't think it's too far out in left field to say what you're about to see is that they represent earthly powers. And yes, we will get to know them. The point I'm trying to make is that these nations that we will see have reached the human pinnacle of human power. They rule the entire world at the time. This is as good as it gets for the human. But the way that they use this power, the way that it spills over into mixing with religion and mixing with forcing people to worship, I don't think it's too far off to say that God immediately in the beginning, by showing us these beasts, is telling us, this isn't me. This is malevolent and it's evil. This is not how he ordered the kingdom. The kingdom before the fall here, and definitely not how the kingdom of heaven is ordered. So as I watched, its wings were plucked off. It was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a human being, like a son of man, and a human mind was given to it. Now, aside from the fact that Babylon is the first metal in the statue, and we know from chapter 2 that he was told, and just as gold was their decadence of choice, if you will, this also matches Babylon besides that. Because all you have to do is unearth Babylonian art, and Babylonian art is full of winged lions. They loved winged lions. They're everywhere. The Ishtar Gate, which supposedly goes back to Nebuchadnezzar's day, that when I saw it, it was on tour and it was at a museum in Jerusalem. The two pillars are two winged lions holding up the arch to go to the gate. Lions, not just lions, but lions with wings. And together it shows the ultimate strength. Gold being the ultimate in expense, the ultimate in decadence. We were told back in chapter 2, I told you that gold just came out of Nebuchadnezzar's ears. They had so much gold, they didn't know what to do with it. So the strength of the lion and the speed of the eagle actually describes Nebuchadnezzar's experience himself. Nebuchadnezzar's experience in conquering the world. And also to let know that it all of Babylonian power is kind of embodied in Nebuchadnezzar himself. When Daniel tells him that he is the head of gold back in chapter 2, he actually says this. I'm quoting him. He says, "You, O king, are king of kings. You are the ultimate of kings. You are the head of gold." So it doesn't surprise me at all that the lion with wings, the most powerful creature of what it can do, and the speed of an eagle in which to accomplish it, it doesn't surprise me at all that this is used for us to remember Nebuchadnezzar. And also, he's reminding Daniel of something else that we may have forgotten back in chapter 4, is to remember that in this nightmare of human deity, that Nebuchadnezzar himself experienced this. When it says here, what it just said was when the wings were plucked off and he was made to stand up on the ground on his hind legs, isn't that exactly what happened to Nebuchadnezzar? Remember when he went mad, He became an animal and went down on all fours. And for 7 years, he went mad and took on the embodiment of an animal. When God decided to come back to him, when God opened up the invitation to be with him again, he picked Nebuchadnezzar up and put him on his hind legs. And when Nebuchadnezzar got back up on his hind legs, he begins to worship and to acknowledge and to pray to the living God of Israel. We're even told in here that Nebuchadnezzar's conversion to become a born-again would-be king himself to worship the living God, Dr. Dukan says, it's very special that God mentions it here to remind Daniel of his entire role in all of this. So just as the statue moved on from gold down, now down to the shoulders and chest, if you will, the zoo moves down. We move to another cage, if you will. We move down to another display. Okay? And it says, another beast, a second one, resembling a what this time? Again, resembling a bear. It isn't quite a bear. There's something wrong with it. But it does resemble a bear. It was raised up on one side. Three ribs were in its mouth, and between its teeth it thus said, arise and devour much meat. This one's posture is an illustration of its power. It's raised up. It has a prominent hunchback, if you will. Two distinct bodies in one body that resembles a bear. Now, the bear in the Bible is noted particularly for its cruelty. Back in 2 Samuel 17, when Absalom, who has rebelled against his father and is seeking to kill his father David, he has a friend telling him, he said, you know, your father and his men are warriors, and they are enraged like a what? Like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Proverbs 28 says, like a roaring lion or a charging bear is a wicked ruler over a poor people. Amos 5:19, as if someone fled from a lion and was met by a what? Was met by a bear. Biblically, and I don't even want to go into Elisha and a bunch of little boys who called him bald. But biblically, a bear is known for its cruelty. It's known for its viciousness, if you will. And it works out. It works out. About 650 BCE, the Persians were the vassals of the Medes. The Medes actually controlled other nations, but they didn't necessarily make them live with each other. They had their own land and they had their own autonomy, but they certainly were, like I said, like this says, they were vassals, the way the history books put it. They conducted their own government and they owned their own land, but it was to the south of Media. The book of Esther is the very first one to use or describe this nation as the nation of the Medes and the Persians, which the book of Esther takes place during that time. Ahasuerus is a Persian king. There's one history textbook that describes this empire two in one. The Persian Empire had been created in a single generation by Cyrus the Great. In 559 BCE, he came to the throne of Persia, then a small kingdom well to the east of the lower Mesopotamian valley, unifying them under his rule, makes an alliance with Babylon, and leads a successful rebellion to the north against the Medes, who were the overlords of Persia. The three main conquests in which they did to do this were to defeat Lydia, to defeat Egypt, and to defeat Babylon, which they did in chapter 5. So this bear is seen as the conquest or the remainder of that conquest with these three ribs, these three great conquests. These three great nations at the time, Egypt, Lydia, and Babylon, and all that's left of them is what? Is these three bones that he has in his mouth. Because otherwise he's destroyed everything. So it goes along with the statue in Medo-Persia. we're making our way down. And I want you to notice just this little illustration of these, how much bigger these kingdoms get. This is about twice the land size of Babylon, the Medo-Persian kingdom. It starts to get bigger. It starts to spread out. It begins to become more humanly successful, if you will. 539 to 331 BC. After this, as we move, and we move down now to the stomach and the statue, but it says, after this, I watched another, as I watched, another appeared, like a what? Like a leopard. The beast had four wings of a bird on its back and four heads and dominion given to it. When you think of leopard, what do you think of? You think of speed, right? It's already fast. And what is it given? Four wings. It makes it even what? Makes it even faster. It's a complete speed, if you will. The number four is a totality, and the complete speed of it was reached. Did this happen with Greece or did it not? It did. It happened with Greece. And I won't go into it too much now, but when we get to chapter 8, I'll talk a little bit more about Alexander the Great and how amazing this really was, how fast he really accomplished this. And notice how as it grows, something else is going on. This beast is given what? It's given dominion. I want you to notice it's the first one to be given this power. So you see the strength in the human power, beginning with Babylon, and it may go down in value in the statue, gold, silver, and we'll go brass and we'll go iron. It may go down in value, but the strength at which these nations operate, the human strength at which they conquer becomes more and more absolute as it goes on. This is the first one that said it was given dominion. They were allowed to rule, truly rule, over the land, the nation, the peoples that it was given to. Babylon wasn't given that. Babylon was given the heart of a man. Medo-Persia is only given the fill of flesh. Only the leopard has dominion granted to it. See, each is a certain kind of dominion, but up until this one, they're limited. A lion with a human heart, that's dominion just over the beasts. Okay? They're the ultimate in human at the time, but there are other humans that are getting ready to take advantage of their weaknesses. Medo-Persia comes along, and it's able to conquest, and it conquers Babylon, it conquers everyone else, but in the end, it's still just a heap of flesh. It's just a pile of bones. People that they slaughtered in order to conquer. This one, though, this is given spatial dominion. And you think, Greece. Why Greece? Why was it given this? Well, think about it. It's a complete conquer of the nature of human nature. Greek thought, culture, literature, architecture, mythology has infiltrated itself everywhere. By the way, Greek thought is still the backbone of Western thought. Our entire philosophical system of us in the West is all based on Greek culture. Alexander completely Hellenized the world. He was given dominion everywhere, and it's never gone away. Even up until this day. Our system of politics, our system of culture, our rule of law, our philosophical systems, Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, it's still with us today. Some good things, yeah, and some bad things too. It's still our backbone. So Greece proves itself to be even stronger as it grows. Then something else happens. After this, I saw in the visions by night a what? Beast number four. Terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth, was devouring, breaking in pieces, and stamping what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that preceded it, and it had what? It had 10 horns. We have now left. As we walked the other three displays, they all had some sort of zoological classification, like a lion, like a bear, like a leopard. We get to this one, and he is unlike anything. This zoological classification is terrifying and dreadful. That's all Daniel can come up with to describe this beast. And remember, it's the legs of iron and the feet of iron and clay. Iron, what does iron do as far as metals are concerned? It smashes everything it comes in contact with. And what the iron doesn't smash, it now conquers with its feet, because even in the statue, the feet had iron and clay in it. There was nothing else like it. Iron teeth. One out of the four directly relates to the metal of the statue. And again, Daniel says, there isn't anything that's come before it to compare. And I'll tell you too, I don't think there's anything that has come since that can compare to Rome. Probably look maybe a little bit more like this. So what I would consider pagan Rome, Rome that begins and ends, goes this way, from 168 BC to 476 CE, if you will. In 142, Rome takes Macedonia, annexes it, and then takes Greece by the end of 168. The iron belongs to the Romans. They have iron swords and shields and armor and helmets and spears, and it's more than a metal. They crush and smash everything in its way. Their strength lay in the way they governed, a highly advanced form of politics. They took the Greek formation of polis and they elevated it into something we've never, ever seen before. It is the world's first republic in human history. It's able to control from afar the most diverse of all peoples. In other words, they don't have to be there in order to rule over you. They ruled over you by threat and by taxes. Pay your taxes, mouth allegiance to Caesar, promise to never rebel, and Rome pretty much let you do what you wanted. They didn't care about what your religion was, unless your religion fed, if you will, a heart of rebellion when it came to paying your taxes or having an allegiance to Caesar. It is known as the Peace of Rome, Pax Romana. Why? Why was it so peaceful? Because everybody was scared to death. Nobody wanted to challenge them. The victories were crushing. I came, I saw, I conquered. If that weren't enough, resistance beyond that was dealt with swiftly and severely. In Gaul, they had to burn entire villages to the ground. They got to the Druids and they completely pressed them. They murdered them. They murdered the forests in which they live. They destroyed Carthage. The siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD, it is said that the siege was so effective that when anybody began to jump over the wall, rather than just take them prisoner or rather than just kill them, they decided to crucify them. Josephus, the Greek historian, okay, who witnessed the siege of Jerusalem, he said that you could not walk through the Kidron Valley with your arms out without hitting a cross. It was just from cross to cross to cross to cross. Nothing but rotting, living human beings. That when Titus actually comes over the hill to claim victory after this siege, he actually becomes sick at his stomach. You did not mess with Rome. It'll last 500 years longer than any of the others. And there's no beast to coincide with the iron and the clay from the statue. It's a continuous line. So it's not just the legs of iron. The 10 horns also take us all the way down to the feet, mixed with irons and clay. If you want to count toes, then yes, that gives us 10 if you'd like. But it's mixed with clay. 10 tones, 10 horns. And it's different because it has a human face. This is the first one that will be given a human face for you to understand and for me to understand that this is the pinnacle of human power, human wisdom. There's never been anything or anyone like it. And Daniel is considering them. He's considering them because what happens is that those 10 horns now sees the kingdom divide at about 350 CE. The division almost becomes complete. And then that's going to take this new entity, the feet, the divided Rome, if you will, what we would call the Holy Roman Empire. It's going to go all the way to the end of the world. They may not have the political power that the Holy Roman Empire once had, but the idea of taking the ultimate in human political power and will and mixing it then with the ultimate religious power of the day, that's going to live until the end of time. That's going to fuel our true worship versus false worship. That's the entire basis of these two churches in the end time, the church of the two beasts or the church of the Lamb that was slain. It all starts here. I was considering the horns, and another horn appeared, a little one coming up among them. To make room for it, three of the earlier horns were plucked up by the roots. There were eyes like a what? There were eyes like a human eyes, and this horn, and in this horn, and a mouth who spoke arrogantly. History will confirm this. In the last half of the fourth century, the Germanic tribes would follow the initiative of the Huns, and they would invade what has become a too decadent Roman Empire. They've spread themselves way too thin, they've done it too fast, and they cannot sustain through corrupt Caesars anymore its wealth. And these Germanic tribes begin to take advantage of it. They see an opportunity to be able to take advantage of it. And so the Huns were the very first to invade. And on the ruins of the Roman Empire, these 10 kingdoms arise. The list varies. Most historians will say the Franks, the Burgundians, the Huns, the Vandals, the Suevi, the Visigoths, the Saxons, the Ostrogoths, the Lombards, and the Heruli. Yes, we have fought in several general conferences the exact identification of all of them. Fought tooth and nail as Adventists. And what we never noticed is that Daniel isn't interested in the 10 horns at all. Because once he sees the little horn, that is the only one that he's interested in. But leave it to us Adventists, let's fight over the 10 Germanic tribes. He only wants to know what's up with this little one. What's up with him? I desire to know the exact meaning of what? The fourth beast, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke arrogantly and that seemed to be greater than the others. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. This one shall be different from the former ones and shall put down 3 kings. This little horn will speak words against the Most High, shall wear out the holy ones of the Most High, shall attempt to change the sacred seasons and the law, and they shall be given power in other words, the holy ones, the saints, the true worshipers of God, they will be given into the power of this little horn for a time, 2 times, and half a time. The little horn now becomes the focus of this chapter. And he's different than the others. He has a face. Remember chapter 2, we were told that it's a political and a religious power. The iron represents all the political might of Rome, but the clay, it's a religious power. The clay in which you bake idols, the clay in which you bake tablets in which you can print the word. Clay is always associated with religion back then. The human face then is ready to testify that the political power is now conquered the religious power, and together we will conquer all. That this is now the ultimate in human ideal, the ultimate in human power. All the political power of the Roman Empire and all of the religious power of the Christian church brought together. And when it's brought together, Daniel is so terrified that it makes him sick. It comes up because it caused the downfall of 3 of them. Another horn, a little one, as I said, corresponds with the feet of iron and clay, this mixture of religious power. Because 3/4 of a century before this, it's told that three of these horns would be plucked up. We've always known these to be the three Arian branches of Christianity. Those who followed the monk, if you will, Arius, the very first serious heresy of the Christian church, and that was that Jesus was not a divine creature. He was begat of God. There are three of these tribes who still follow them. And they've made their way and beginning to settle in the western part of the Roman Empire. They are settling in what we know is the peninsula of Italy. The Visigoths, the Vandals, and the Ostrogoths. Well, beginning in 508, Clovis, the king of the Franks, who is nicknamed the new Constantine, if you will, he's baptized. And as soon as he's out of the water baptizing, he goes to war with the Visigoths and he wipes them out. A few years later, Justinian, who's the governor of the Eastern Roman Empire, he's declared pope and ruler of all the holy priests, the very first Holy Roman Emperor to be given that title, and he declares wars on the two remaining Arians. And he defeats the Vandals in 534 and drives them completely out, and he defeats the Ostrogoths in 538. In case you don't know, we now have a starting point for the numbers part of this prophecy. And we don't have time to get into it today. We will do it next week. 538 is the starting point. He'll speak words against the Most High, shall wear out the holy ones of the Most High, shall attempt to change the secret seasons and the law, shall be given into his power for a time, two time, and half a time. So this is what he does. He speaks against the Most High. He's a human. He's the ultimate in human power, telling the ultimate in religious power of the earth at the day, I'm against you. I've defeated you. I've brought you together in this, into this force that cannot be defeated. And when you come together with power like that, he has to be worshiped. In John 13, that's the way he'll put it. And the whole world worshiped the beast. Why? Because on the surface, why wouldn't you? Isn't that what we've been looking for? Ultimate power to be worshiped? He'll wear out the saints of the highest one. Those who will not submit to the fear, the force, and the coercion that this power will use in order to make you worship him, those people will be persecuted. He'll make alterations in times and in law and be given into his hand for time, two times, and half a time. Real quick before we get there next week, the Jewish calendar has 360 days. We see the time as year, if you will. So 1 year, 2 years, and a half a year. 360 times 3 plus 180 equals 1,260 years. This thing will have its ultimate power and it will rule the earth. And we saw it in history. History bore it out. So from 538 to 1798 is how this will reign, and we'll talk about 1798 next week. It ends when a general from Rome actually takes the Pope captive and hauls him into France. And General Bonaparte declares that the Catholic Church's rule over France is done. And when it happens in France, it happens in the rest of Europe. The church is confronted with this one atheistic authority, reason. It has the ultimate of earthly power, the ultimate of religious power. Why wouldn't you worship it? That's reason. The medieval church, the Dark Ages, the medieval Roman Catholic Church, the Holy Roman Empire, it completely fitting in with this prophecy. And I wish I could just leave it at that. By the way, Adventists weren't the ones to figure this out. The Millerites weren't the ones to figure this prophecy out. This idea that it was the Holy Roman Empire has been around forever. Luther felt that way. The Reformers felt that way. There are actual Catholic scholars who wrote that the papacy was this, that the Holy Roman Empire was this. They did it at risk. They were calling out their own church. But I just have to remind you that living today, this power doesn't manifest itself that way anymore, does it? We're not in the Dark Ages anymore. We don't live in medieval times. That particular church now works for well over half of the world's humanitarian efforts. They don't have the political will ever that they used to have. And we also have to remember that the first beast only goes for a particular amount of time. It's the second beast that then takes over. And for the last 400 years of that 1260-year prophecy, for the last 400 years, it was Protestants who was living out this power. It was Protestants who were seeking political power in order to exist. I hate when I hear somebody want to try and pick on the modern Roman Catholic Church for something that happened in the Dark Ages that simply doesn't even apply anymore. And we're willing to ignore the second beast who is alive and well and actively working right now in our nation and around the world. Why? Because it's convenient. And it's a whole lot more fun to pick on a former enemy to feel good about ourselves. I think he died. Give me one slide, Grady. Give me one slide. This is done. It's not working. I'm just going to keep reading. So if you could follow me. So is it frozen out too? We're almost there. If you guys can just listen to me, you're going to have to trust me that this is what these verses say. Okay. In 7:28, it says, "Here the account ends. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly terrified. My face turned pale, but I kept the matter in mind." So what do we do with this now? For Daniel, it disturbs him. For Daniel, he's deeply disturbed at what he sees. Because if you think about it, this is a worshiper of the living God who actually is living through what this describes. It's not describing his exact experience, but this is somebody who's being martyred or at least being persecuted by this power. He's been taken captive by this Babylonian power. And it disturbs him that someday, it disturbs him that this thing is going to rule the world for 1260 years. It makes him pale. It makes him sick. "My thoughts greatly terrified me. My face turned pale, but I kept the matter in mind." We have to remember what we do with this. If we want to dare to be a Daniel, we need to do with this information what he did with this information. This divine power co-opted to manipulate and force worshipers. This political, military, secular might to enforce that hijacking. By the way, he's dedicated his entire life and ministry to be trusted by these earthly gods who are using this power. He recognizes that God has placed them under his authority and that he put a love in Daniel's heart for these captives. He doesn't abandon Nebuchadnezzar when things go bad. He doesn't abandon Darius when things go bad. So I want you to ponder this. If you're going to walk out of here and begin to paint all things Roman Catholic as all things of this beast. As I pointed out in the beginning, if you're going to do that with a prophecy, you're going to hurt real people. You're not going to be hurting a power. You're not going to be hurting a power that sits in Italy. You're going to be hurting 1.2 billion actual people worldwide. And I will tell you, it makes us look petty. It makes us look more like the beast than we would not want to be looked like. Daniel's love and respect, his friend's brave, non-accusatory declaration all the way into the furnace, their empathy as sinners with these other sinners against these self-proclaimed gods of the versus the kingdom of the living God. Remember this, martyrdom wins people because you have laid down your life for a friend. Who does Daniel sound like in all this? Well, it'll sound like when we get to the next part of chapter 7, because in the middle of all this, not in the middle, but after the end, after we see the earthly power come all the way to its pinnacle, then it says that an Ancient of Days came. A judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One. The time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. It's not by accident that the ultimate and earthly power voices his dominion over everybody, and the Ancient of Days shows up at that moment to judge that power. And when he judges it wanting. And he judges in favor of you and me rather than this power. The Ancient of Days. Jesus' saints took possession of the kingdom, it says. Back then, took possession of the kingdom. Wait a minute, how could they take possession of it? We're not even near 1798. It's because when did the judgment occur? When did the judgment occur on all human power? At the cross. You and I took possession of the kingdom the day that he won the kingdom for us. Daniel just is a God who's willing to 1,000 years before he comes to inform his people that don't worry, hang on, I'm coming. To me, that's the spirit of Daniel 7. That's what we should walk away from this with. In John 13, 19, I had this scripture reading for a reason. Jesus said, I tell you this now before it occurs, so that when it does occur, you may believe that I am he. Do you know the only way to know that a prophecy has been fulfilled is after it's been fulfilled? Prophecy is not about predicting the future. Prophecy is not about being so sure that something's going to happen that that is what's going to happen. Jesus said the only way that you know a prophecy has been fulfilled is after it's been fulfilled. And here we are nearly 2,000 years after its fulfillment. He just loved us enough to tell us 1,000 years beforehand. It's what he wanted for his children. John 17, 17, sanctify them in truth. Your word is truth. Righteous Father, although the world is not known you yet, I have known you, and these have known you that you have sent me. And I made your name known to them, and I will make it known so that the love of which you loved me may be in them and I in them. So I'm asking our church, who has had this information for 180 years, but for more often than not, we have decided to focus on the features of the little horn and paint every Catholic of Catholic Christianity with this power. And the prophecy is plain to tell us it isn't the people. It's not even necessarily the church. The church just represents the religious power in the two that come together. At the time, the medieval church, the Roman Catholic Church, was the largest Christian body there was. It wasn't that the church was evil. It was that the church embraced the power of the Roman Empire. That's now what becomes evil. That's the power of the beast. So we don't have a right. If the church no longer seeks that kind of power, we don't have a right to judge the church part. We don't even have a right to judge the world part. But when they come together, now that's our right to judge it. And as I pointed out, the second beast is already well on its way in doing his evil. And we're still focusing on what a man might be doing or not be doing over in the Vatican. Remember that the evil of the little horn is any religious community that allows intolerance, anti-Semitism, racism, anti-Islam, Islamophobia, any human tradition that will prevail over love, respect, and faithfulness for divine revelation. That's the beast. The world power may not be necessarily evil in itself. The religious power may not be necessarily evil in itself. Bring them together and it's evil for sure. That's what we see in Daniel 7. That's what we see in the zoo. When I first got to our first church after seminary, I joined a ministerial association that it was kind of the Misfits Ministerial Association. I didn't join the mainstream one that had all of the evangelicals in it. I joined what they called themselves the Misfits. It was the United Methodist pastor, it was the Episcopalian pastor, and it was the Roman Catholic priest. We all got together and we met once a month. We had coffee, we had a meal. We even went on a retreat once. Father Bruce actually took us to a Catholic retreat over on the coast, the Mendocino coast, that we just spent a day just meditating. We spent a day just being with God out there. We got to be pretty good friends. We lost contact a little bit. And then one day I got a phone call from one of my best friends who was the CEO of the hospital, the Adventist hospital there. And it's a tiny hospital. It was a 90-year-old hospital. It was very tiny. The ICU was, it was no bigger than this platform. There was only 3 beds in the ICU. There were only 18 beds in the entire hospital. But he asked me if I could come in because it seemed that the priest was there and he was extremely, extremely upset. Because what had happened was that he came in to visit a member, and it was in this ICU, and there were like 3 families who were all trying to see their loved one at the same time. And the ER doctor, who happens to be the on-call physician that's taking care of anyone, she just had it, and she kicked everybody out. She said, "We can't care for anybody more. You got to get out." Father Bruce was in the midst of anointing his patient, and she yelled at him and told him to get out. And it seemed like he had it. Something had happened. He just completely melted down. And so they took him immediately to Kevin's office. Kevin came down, the CEO, my best friend, and he tried to get his story. He said, "But, you know, what's going on? What happened?" You know. And he said, I knew this would happen when I moved to this town. And I found out that this was an Adventist hospital. I knew you would be against me. I knew you would try to stand in the way of my ministry and my church. And Kevin's going, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." So he called me and he says, "Greg, you know Bruce, don't you?" I said, "Sure." So I invited him to lunch. And like I said, we hadn't seen each other in a long time. But I have to tell you, the last time we saw him, there was a small organization of just a few believers from other churches that we were doing a service, an Easter service every Sunday together. And we were asked in consecutive years. I was asked to do the devotion for it this particular year. And we had about 3 or 4 musicians from my church that they wanted them to do praise songs in the song service too. So it was kind of done by us that year. The following year, they asked Bruce. So we were together. And up until this incident, I hadn't seen him, like I said, for about a year. So I want to get to the bottom of it. I want to find out. I buy him lunch, and he comes to my office. We sit down, and we just start eating. And I said, "Bruce," I said, so I tried to explain to him that this wasn't an Adventist thing. I said, "The hospital is administrated by the Adventists, but we don't have any Adventist policies or anything within it." I said, "That doctor is not Adventist, is not carrying anything out. She said that she had just lost control there and she was trying to get control back." And he says, "Okay." He says, "I guess I can understand that." But then he reaches in his pocket and he pulls out this paperback edition done by Remnant Publishing of The Great Controversy, and he throws it at me. Across the table, he throws it at me. He said, "Well, what about this?" And I said, "Where'd you get this?" He said, "3 Sundays ago, I came out of my church, and some people decided that we needed that book. In fact, if the windows were open in the car, they actually placed the book inside the car, or they put it on the windshield. It was early 2000s, and the Remnant Publishing wasn't even an official publication of the Great Controversy. And it's extremely anti-Catholic. It has horrible pictures and illustrations in there. They endorse things in there that the Adventist Church would never, ever endorse, the conclusions that they've come to. And he said, well, I want to know then what Adventists decided that that's what my church needed when we came out of our worship service on Sunday 3 weeks ago. I explained it to him the best I could. I talked to him about our extremists, about our fundamentalists. We were there for 2 more years. I never saw him again. I lost a friend. The Adventist community of that town lost a friend. Until the Ancient One came, the judgment was given for the Holy Ones of the Most High. And the time arrived when the Holy Ones gained possession of the kingdom. The saints took possession of the kingdom. We have possession of the kingdom because of the Ancient of Days in this prophecy. If we may not know what to do 100%, let's just begin to act like it. You with me? I'm sorry if you felt that I had to take you to task, but this is real. This is the end time. We've been pitted against each other in this. And I believe that nothing is solved unless we bring it into the light.
I've never heard a sermon like this. Wonderful.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. I trust you with the message. And if we're unsure, let's get together. Let's talk about it. It's the Ancient of Days. It's not the little horn. We'll come back next week. We'll talk about this judgment now. We'll talk about the time, 538, 1798, and then move to 1844. We're going to do it all, okay? We're going to do it all. But thank you for a little bit of time. Thank you for your patience in listening. And we just pray that God would do something for all of us with our heart, okay?